Hi, everybody, and welcome to Tomorrow Never Knows, a Beatles podcast. I don't know if you've heard the first episode, but if you have, you might remember me talking about how I'm going to go more in depth about the Beatles cartoons, and I'm going to do that today. And I'm going to cite a book called Beatletunes by Mitchell Axelrod, a fantastic, fantastic book about the cartoons. The research in that is absolutely incredible. You couldn't do it today because most of the people that he speaks to aren't around with us anymore. So as I've said before, the first time I got into the Beatles was through the cartoons. That's how I got into them. I remember in the 70s when I was a kid, the cartoons were on in the mornings before school, and it just absolutely blew my mind. The cartoons blew my mind. They were funny, they were entertaining, and the music, of course, was just unbelievable. I think I knew all the words to A Hard Day's Night and Help before I did my ABCs. Well, I don't think that. I'm pretty sure that I did that. And all my friends that are into the Beatles got into it through the cartoon as well. I think most of the people from my generation did. And even my friends who aren't into the Beatles remember the cartoon and love the cartoon. So I think the story of the cartoon needs to be told, and it has been told in Mitchell Axelrod's book. But since it's unavailable, well, I'm pretty sure it's unavailable. I've looked for it and I can't find it. I've got my copy. I'm going to talk about the story and the creation of the cartoon. So the cartoon was, each episode was a half hour episode and consisted of 2 5.5 minute episodes. And each episode was loosely based on the lyrics of a Beatles song. And when I say loosely, I mean really loosely. And in between the two episodes, there were two sing-alongs, which one of the Beatles, George, John or Paul, would encourage the audience to sing to one of the songs. And Ringo was the comic relief. He was always the filling in for the prop man who was always on vacation. So that's the structure of the cartoon. But how did the cartoon come about? Well, there was this guy called Al Brodax who owned a company called King Features. Now, you might remember them. They did a lot of Popeye cartoons back in the 50s and in the 60s. But you might remember them from Snuffy Sniff, Crazy Cat, and I think the other one, what was it? Beetle Bailey. Yeah, that's right. Beetle Bailey was the other one. And one day in King Features' office, this guy, Cyben Bick, wanders in. And he's looking very confused and he's walking around and Brodax sees him and follows him and asks him if everything's all right. So Bick tells Brodax that he has the license to publish a Beatles comic strip. And Brodax says, well, is it just for comic strip or is it for animation? And Bricks didn't understand what Brodax was talking about. So he asked him for the name of his lawyer and he gave him the name, and Brodax contacts this lawyer and they make a deal to give Brodax the right to produce the Beatles cartoons. And it was that simple at the beginning. So by the time they get everything together, everything's signed off, it's 1964. And as we know, the Beatles are the hottest property in the world, basically ever. So Brodax is very happy and he hurriedly goes and gets some caricatures drawn of the Beatles. He's not happy with them, but he's trying to get funding. So he's looking around for funding, and someone suggests he goes and sees a guy called Isaacson, who was president of the A.C. Gilbert Toy Company at the time. And so he goes to Isaacson's office, and Isaacson's a very busy man, and he's got an appointment, but Isaacson can't see him, and he's just walking in and out of his office, and Brodax has had enough, and he just pulls up Isaacson and shows him the characters and says, "I've got the rights to the Beatles cartoon," and straight away Isaacson says, "I'll buy it." Isaacson then calls the president of ABC TV, tells him that he's just funded a Beatles cartoon, and the president of ABC has just gone, "Yep, I'll take it," straight away. And Isaacson buys half of the commercial slots straight away for his company, for his toy company, because he thinks he's going to sell tons and tons and tons of toys, and they get a deal for the 1965 season. The other half of the commercials was sold to Quaker Oats and the Mars Candy Company. Now, the commercial slots were sold for $500,000 per 30 seconds. And you have to remember that this was at a time when the average wage was $40 a week. So Brodax has got 6 months to produce a cartoon series from scratch. Okay, he's got to find a studio who could produce stories quickly, script writers, animators, people to do the voices. But most importantly, he had to find someone who was able to define the Beatles' characters and caricatures. So Brodax hires a 21-year-old named Peter Sandor to design the Beatles' animations. And Peter saw John as the leader, Paul as a poised and stylish man, George was loose-limbed and angular, and Ringo was kind and sad. And according to Brodax, everyone loved it. Everyone loved the animation, and even the Beatles themselves loved it. So Brodax hired four writers, and he came up with an idea for zany storylines. So if the Beatles' popularity did die down in the future, he could still put the cartoons into syndication because it'd have these storylines that appeal to kids. And, you know, he chose things like storylines with ghosts, cowboys, ships at sea, all these exotic locations. And he would have, he'd have 10-minute meetings with the writers, and he would say things like, "Okay, the Beatles go to Transylvania, a vampire girl falls in love with Ringo, and she chases him around to the song Babies in Black." And Brodax would, he'd send the writers albums, and he would tick the songs that they were allowed to use due to copyright, because you have to remember, this was the early 60s, and before Capitol signed the Beatles, they were on all these different labels. They were on Tolly, they were on Swan, they were on VJ, and they owned the rights to certain songs, so they couldn't use any song they wanted to use. And it wasn't until the Beatles cartoon was over that Capitol Records actually got back the rights to use all those songs. One writer remembers that there was a lot of competition for songs. You'd write an episode for a song like If I Fell, for example, and another writer had already used it, so you would have to change your storyline to fit another song. And he said, and it was just tough luck. It was first in, first served. So every script had to be approved by Brodax and then sent to the ABC, who approved it, then sent back to Brodax, then sent back to the writers, and then the writers could work on it. The writers got paid $400 a pop for each script. It didn't matter how long it took. So the writers would speed up writing the scripts so they could collect the next paycheck. So I'm just going to quickly read to you a page from a script. This is one of the sing-alongs, and it says it goes for 57 seconds. And the setting is Beatles apartment as described in set three. Paul is seated at the piano. Paul, to viewers. Now for the part of the show in which we all get you to sing along with us. Ringo interrupting. Hold it, Paul. That's no way to start a sing-along. Paul. It isn't? Ringo. Of course not. You first got to create the proper atmosphere of the song, the right stage. Then Ringo goes around setting up all this electrical stuff, makes it look like Frankenstein's lab. With these words, Ringo starts zipping around the apartment in a blur, gathering props. In a few seconds, he's constructed an enormous electrical dynamo in the center of the room. Ringo now wears overalls, a machinist cap, and carries an oil-filled squirt gun. Ringo, there. Ain't that better? As Ringo speaks, he leans into the starter switch, turning on the huge dynamo with a loud whirring noise. Sparks fly and it starts vibrating violently before the entire thing explodes. As the smoke clears, we find Ringo and Paul with charred, shredded clothing and blackened faces. Paul, this is your decoration for an electrifying number? Ringo, yeah, shocking, ain't it? Huh? Yeah. Paul, to viewers, sing people. Then underneath it says start song, but it doesn't specify what song it is, so I guess the writers just wrote these little things and you could fit them into any song. So what about the Beatles' voices? Brodax had already hired Paul Frees, who had done the voice of Ignatz from the cartoon Crazy Cat. He'd also done Boris Badenoff from Rocky and Bullwinkle and worked on cartoons like Dudley Do-Right and George of the Jungle and one of my all-time favourites, The Impossibles. Another guy was used, Lance Percival, and he tells the story. He says, I knew the Beatles in the 60s because I was in a hot television show called That Was the Week That Was when they got going. I did a couple of TV slots with them in the early days, and then I made a few records with their producer, George Martin. The song Shame and Scandal in the Family made the UK hit parade in 1964. All this had nothing to do with being cast in the cartoons, as they had no say in it. Lance remembers being sent down to the audition for the part. I got the job through my agent, who sent me for an audition with Big Al Brodax. The fact I knew the Beatles may have helped, but I did audition as many others did, and I was asked to play the parts of Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr. It was also decided that Paul Frees would provide the voices of John Lennon and George Harrison. Any parts that were spoken by a female were provided by Englishwoman Jackie Newman. All other incidental characters were voiced by Paul Frees as well. Ed Vane of ABC says, I think it was either May or June 1965 when I went to London with Al Brodax and Paul Frees. We met Lance Percival there. Since ABC had the approval of what voices should sound like, we had to listen to their various attempts at coming up with proper voices for each of the four. There was never any attempt to do an impression of the Beatles. These had to be cartoon voices. After many experiments and a lot of trial and error, four voices were selected. So Lance says he played Paul McCartney bright and cheerful, and Ringo was portrayed as the low-voiced fall guy for the humour. He said he made Ringo's voice a little bit more Birmingham and more slowly. So Paul Frees decided to do John's voice in a more Rex Harrison-type character, but the decision was taken to Americanize the voices. They thought that the kids wouldn't really understand a Liverpudlian voice. So they did the mid-Atlantic thing they used to do in those days. And because of this, Brian Epstein decided to ban the cartoon from England. And according to Brodax, the Beatles loved the cartoon when it first came out because the ratings were so high, but then as the years went on they kind of didn't like it that much anymore because they didn't like the voices. Lance Percival said that the recording sessions for the voices went from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. They couldn't go past 6 p.m. because then they would have to pay them overtime, which wasn't in their budget, and they'd try and get as many episodes done as possible in that time frame. He also says that they would try things, they would try and experiment with a couple of things. Sometimes I left things in, sometimes they took things out. But one thing they did leave in, which Percival says he did by accident, was Ringo's, yeah, which to me is one of the defining aspects of the Ringo character and of the Beatles cartoon altogether. So let's look at the opening and closing credits for the cartoons. The opening for the first year consisted of the Beatles trying to escape the claws of crazed female fans. It began with their instrumental portion of the song A Hard Day's Night. Then the Beatles encounter the girls. They jump out of a window and down a fire escape to the tune of Can't Buy Me Love. This is very similar to the scene in the Beatles movie A Hard Day's Night, in which the Beatles escape down a fire escape to the same tune as the opening. After a few more fan encounters and a few more of the Beatles' antics, they finally reach the stage and they play for the crowd. Brodax recalls that the screaming that was used in the opening was lifted from Shea Stadium, which he said was historic, and later he said it was historic and hysterical. The second season was a little less hectic and less ambitious than the first season opening. The Beatles in disguise try to escape their hysterical fans. After being discovered, they end up at a construction site where they are still tracked down by fans. All this is taking place while the song Help was being played. The third and final opening was perhaps the best and most ambitious opening of the three. I personally think it was the best. The song that was played throughout the opening was a relatively obscure Beatles song at the time called And Your Bird Can Sing, which, yeah, that, to me that was sort of like, I'm glad they did it, but it's kind of a bit of a weird choice. This opening featured the Beatles in both animated and real-life form. The real-life Beatles were seen throughout the opening in the form of pictures. The pictures were from the years 65 and on. Some of the pictures would be shown and then would turn into animated versions of the same pictures. Some unusual pictures were chosen, such as the Beatles in a scene from their second movie, Help. The scene was when they were in disguise, fake mustaches and beards, and going to hide in the Bahamas. The opening also included the 1967 official publicity Beatles photo. The same picture was used as the American picture sleeve for the Beatles single release of the song Hello Goodbye. That was really the first time the younger kids were seeing their rock idols in a little different light. The photo had the Beatles in their new look, which included real beards and mustaches. The times were changing and so were the Beatles. The opening was a little more psychedelic, which was another reflection of the times. It had scenes from the series interspersed with typical cartoon Beatles antics, very different from the previous two Beatles openings. The closing credits remain the same for all the years the series aired. It began with the song A Hard Day's Night, playing as one by one Paul, John and George unplugged their respective guitars. Then it was Ringo's turn. When he went to unplug his instrument, the drums deflated and the fun began. I've spoken about that before, that as a kid that used to crack me up every time when his drums deflated. Of course there was a chase scene by the fans. The Beatles' antics lead them off a pier and into the water where they assume to be safe only to be chased by mermaids. So by this time, Brodax had the rough cuts of the cartoons and it was time for the head honchos themselves to come and have a view. Yep, the Beatles were going to come and check it out. And Norman Kaufman remembers, he says, here was me, this 17-year-old kid with his movie camera ready to film the arrival of the Beatles. In those days, in order to shoot film, you had to have a lot of lighting. I found four spotlights on a frame and a cine camera in the middle. And as I walked in, I switched my lights on and started filming. I got into trouble because George Harrison didn't like it very much that we were filming. He thought they were just coming back to have a little chat and to meet the people who were going to do their cartoons. And there was this kid with a camera. he got rather annoyed, and I captured this on film. And that's sort of George. That's a bit typical of George, actually. If you read a lot of things, he does get annoyed very easily. You can tell by his face how annoyed he was. But John Lennon decided that that wasn't fair. He's this young kid trying to make a bit of a film, and he came out and posed for me. Good old John. After the filming, he started chatting with me. We all got along quite well. Actually, the studio conference room was set up as a makeshift screening room where the Beatles were shown two completed films. Ed Vane of ABC remembers the reaction of the Beatles. It was very positive. They were extremely amused by it. Ringo especially. He was chuckling away and making little comments and joshing about the others. The mood when it was all done was one of pleasure and enjoyment on the part of the Beatles. They liked it at first, recalls Lance Percival. It was an ego thing, but then they got picky. I didn't hear what John was saying because I portrayed his voice, but Paul was sitting in the front of me asking who was doing his voice. Ringo was okay with it all, and he said to me, "I see you've made me the dum-dum." I told him, "No, that's just the way the scripts were written." Afterwards, there was a cocktail party and a buffet for the studio representatives and the television representatives and the media and, of course, the Beatles themselves. It had proven to be a very hectic day for the Beatles. Later on, they go on to say a few more things about the party, and they talk about George. They were saying he was in a bad mood and he wasn't very communicative. They said John was very funny, very pleasant, and there was all this awesome food around, but he spotted a hot dog stand down in the street and he sent people down to get hot dogs. So he preferred the hot dogs. And they said Paul was very smart. He was very cluey, and he was asking them questions that maybe an advertising exec might be able to ask. And they said the weird thing they said about Ringo was he seemed really shy, and he just sat in the corner, and they tried to talk to him, and there was just one-word answers coming out of Ringo. Then they had a press conference, and then he just dominated the press conference, was really funny, was really charming. And then after the press conference, he sort of like shrunk back into his little self again. So on September the 25th, 1965, at 10:30 a.m., the Beatles cartoon premiered on the ABC network. And they were all very nervous about the ratings because at the time it was considered that people don't animate very well. And this was the first time ever that entertainers had had their own cartoon show. But when the ratings came out, it was a smash success. It was huge. Everyone was abuzz about it. And it helped the record sales immensely. Not that they needed much help. But it introduced millions of kids to the Beatles. Millions of kids like myself and my friends. So there you have it. That's the story of the Beatles cartoon. And I'm very, very grateful to Mitchell Axelrod for writing that book. As I said, it's a fantastic book. And if you can track it down, you probably can on eBay. Hopefully another printing will be done of it. The cartoon seems to be lost. Well, I thought it was lost. No one ever officially released it. You never see it anywhere. And I actually spoke to Mitchell Axelrod on Facebook, or messaged Mitchell Axelrod on Facebook and asked him who owned the cartoon. And he told me that Apple had purchased the cartoon but had no plans to release it in the future, which I think is quite sad. You know, if they a nice box set done in high definition would be very nice. The only mention that I can recall of the cartoon by any of the Beatles was in Anthology, when George was talking about going to meet Elvis, and he said they'd smoked a couple of spliffs in the car on the way, and when they came out, they just all stumbled out of the car exactly like the Beatles cartoon. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Red and Blue albums, which came out in 1973 and were strangely compiled by Alan Klein in a response to a bootleg at the time called Alpha Omega, which was kind of similar. But I'd like to talk a little bit about the songs that were actually used in that. And I think there's some strange selections. Some albums are very underrepresented and some albums are overrepresented. And some of the songs chosen, some of the album tracks chosen, I think are a bit weird. I remember first buying these in the early 80s when I was a kid. These were good for a kid that had no money, as they kind of spanned the whole career from the beginning to the end. And I recently bought the re-release on 180 gram vinyl, which is quite beautiful. Actually, the cover is made of nice cardboard stock. It has the lyrics included. It has a promo sheet in there, and the records look really nice. The red one has the red apple. Blue one has the blue apple. So let's look at the red one first. So side one of the red album has Love Me Do, Please Please Me, From Me to You, She Loves You, I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is all fair enough. They're all singles. But then from With the Beatles, they've picked All My Loving, which I think was a single in the States. I've really got no problem with that. I would have preferred It Won't Be Long, but that's the only real representation from that album. Then it's got Can't Buy Me Love. Side two starts with A Hard Day's Night, of course, from the film. And the only other song from the Hard Day's Night album, which is the first album that was completely filled with Lennon-McCartney songs, is And I Love Her, which I thought was curious. I thought they might have picked, something like I Should Have Known Better. Then we have 8 Days a Week, which is the only representation from Beatles for Sale. I Feel Fine, Ticket to Ride, and Yesterday from Help, and Help, and You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, which is, I don't know. The only reason I think that that's in there, I mean, it's a great song, but the only thing I think that's in there was John's relationship with Alan Klein. You know, Alan Klein wanted to be in John's good books and probably put that in there. And We Can Work It Out, Day Tripper. Good thing about this is that Rubber Soul is well represented in it. So it's got Drive My Car, it's got Norwegian Wood, which I'm really happy about. Nowhere Man, Michelle, In My Life, and Girl. So we have like 6 songs from Rubber Soul, which is good. In My Life and Michelle were never two of my favourites. You know, I would have probably picked something else. You know, maybe put I Want to Tell You in there, or I don't know, just anything else. And then you've got, this is side four, then you've got Paperback Writer. And then from Revolver, we have Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine. Now, I'm not sure if Yellow Submarine is a great choice, but I guess it's a very, very popular song. Oh, and when I said I Want to Tell You, I meant If I Needed Someone. So the curious thing is we have 6 selections from Rubber Soul, which is good, but we only have 2 songs from Revolver. I can't understand that. And that being Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine. I mean, where is Tomorrow Never Knows? Where is I'm Only Sleeping, or She Said, She Said, or Taxman? You know, there's so many great songs on that, and they only took 2 songs from Revolver, which I find to be very strange and very disappointing. But I guess they're catering to the mass population. And if we look at the Blue Album, side one starts with Strawberry Fields, Penny Lane. You can't argue with that. Sergeant Pepper has got the title track With a Little Help from My Friends, Lucy in the Sky, and A Day in the Life. Again, John is heavily represented there in Sergeant Pepper, and I think it's because of his relationship with Alan Klein. Then you got All You Need Is Love. Side two opens with I Am the Walrus instead of Hello Goodbye. That's the B-side to Hello Goodbye, and it's, that's good because it's a much superior song to Hello Goodbye. Fool on the Hill, Magical Mystery Tour, Lady Madonna, Hey Jude, and Revolution. Okay, then we have only the White Album only has three tracks represented, a double album. Probably their best album, only has three tracks represented, and two of the tracks I think are the worst songs on the album. Back in the USSR, don't know why that's there. While My Guitar Gently Weeps is there, I think that's, I think I love that song and I'm glad it's there, but I think it was would have only been placed there to give George some songwriting royalties. And then Obladi Oblada, I mean, what the hell? You know, where's Dear Prudence? Why isn't Dear Prudence in there? Why isn't Happiness Is a Warm Gun there? Or Piggies? Or even Don't Pass Me By is better than Oh Bloody Oh Blada. But I just can't believe that the White Album only gets three songs on it. And then you have Get Back, Don't Let Me Down, The Ballad of John and Yoko, Old Brown Shoe, Here Comes the Sun, Come Together, Something, Octopus's Garden. I guess they're fair choices. You have to put Octopus's Garden in there because you have to give Ringo some songwriting royalties. Then you have Let It Be, Across the Universe, and The Long and Winding Road. So, I mean, it would have been hard compiling that, and I think Klein, for all the absolute shit that he did, actually did a good job with this, but, you know, I question some of his selections, looking at it as a Beatles fan, and, you know, you think you'd, when compiling this, you'd want to put some album tracks that were absolute gems that would want people, you know, which would provoke people to explore those albums, and he hasn't really done that, but they are fantastic albums, and as I said, I bought them when I was younger, and I absolutely loved them, and love them today, and I played them so much that, you know, for example, every time I heard Strawberry Fields, I expected Penny Lane to be played straight after. Or every time I heard Magical Mystery Tour, I expected Lady Madonna to be played straight after. I mean, the tracks were embedded in my head. So that's all I've got to say about the Red and Blue albums. And you've been listening to Tomorrow Never Knows, a Beatles podcast. You can find us on YouTube where you can make comments. I'd love to hear your comments. You can find us on Facebook, join our Facebook page. You can listen to us on Spotify, on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, all those podcast places. You can also contact us on our Facebook page. And if you have any ideas for any future shows, we would love to hear about it. So until next time. Goodbye, goodbye.